He is the man who had Tyndale in his house for 6 months before he ran off to wherever. They say he sends him money still, but that can't possibly be true, as how would he know where to send? Monmouth, I am merely mentioning his name, because... Now, why am I? The Cardinal had closed his eyes. Because I am merely mentioning it. The Bishop of London has already filled his own prisons. He's locking up Lutherans and sectaries in Newgate and the Fleet with common criminals. There they remain until they recant and do public penance. If they relapse, they will be burned. There are no second chances. When Monmouth's house is raided, it is clear of all suspect writings. It's almost as if he was forewarned. There are neither books nor letters that link him to Tyndale and his friends. All the same, he's taken to the Tower. His family is terrified. Monmouth is a gentle and fatherly man, a master draper, well-liked in his guild, and the city at large. He loves the poor, and buys cloth even when trade is bad, so the weavers may keep in work. No doubt the imprisonment is designed to break him. His business is tottering by the time he is released. They have to let him go, for lack of evidence, because you can't make anything of a heap of ashes in the hearth. Monmouth himself would be a heap of ashes if Thomas More had his way. "Not come to see us yet, Master Cromwell," he says. "Still breaking dry bread in cellars? Come now, my tongue is sharper than you deserve. We must be friends, you know." It sounds like a threat. More moves away, shaking his head. "We must be friends." Ashes, dry bread. England was always, the Cardinal says, a miserable country, home to an outcast and abandoned people who are working slowly towards their deliverance and who are visited by God with special tribulations. If England lies under God's curse or some evil spell, it has seemed for a time that the spell has been broken by the Golden King and his Golden Cardinal. But those golden years are over, and this winter the sea will freeze. The people who see it will remember it all their lives. Joanne has moved into the house at Austin Friars with her husband John Williamson, and her daughter, little Joanne, Jo, the children call her, seeing she is too small for a full name. John Williamson is needed in the Cromwell business. "Thomas," says Joanne, "what exactly is your business these days?" In this way she detains him in talk. "Our business," he says, "is making people rich. There are many ways to do this, and John is going to help me out with them." "But John won't have to deal with my Lord Cardinal, will he?" "The gossip is that people of influence, have complained to the King, and the King has complained to Wolsey about the monastic houses he has closed down. They don't think of the good use to which the Cardinal has put the assets. They don't think of the colleges, the scholars he maintains, the libraries he's founding. They're only interested in getting their own fingers in the spoils. And because they've been cut out of the business, they pretend to believe the monks have been left naked and lamenting in the road. They haven't. They've been transferred elsewhere, to bigger houses, better run. Some of the younger ones have been let go, boys who have no calling to the life. Questioning them, he usually finds they know nothing, which makes nonsense of the Abbey's claims to be the light of learning. They can stumble through a Latin prayer, but when you say, 'Go on then, tell me what it means,' they say, 'Means, Master,' as if they thought that words and their meanings were so loosely attached that the tether would snap at the first tug. 'Don't worry about what people say,' he tells Joanne. 'I take responsibility for it. I do, alone.' The Cardinal has received the complaints with a supreme hauteur. He has grimly noted in his file the names of the complainers. Then he has taken out of his file the list and handed it over to his man with a tight smile. All he cares for are his new buildings, his banners flying, his coat of arms embossed on the brickwork, his Oxford scholars. He's plundering Cambridge to get the brightest young doctors over to Cardinal College. There was trouble before Easter, when the Dean found six of the new men in possession of a number of forbidden books. Lock them up by all means, Wolsey said. Lock them up and reason with them. If the weather is not too hot or not too wet, I might come up and reason with them myself. No use trying to explain this to Joanne. She only wants to know her husband's not within arrow shot of the slanders that are flying. You know what you are doing, I suppose. Her eyes dart upwards. At least, Tom, you always look as if you do. Her voice, her footstep, her raised eyebrow, her pointed smile, everything reminds him of Liz. Sometimes he turns, thinking that Liz has come into the room. The new arrangements confuse Grace. She knows her mother's first husband was called Tom Williams. They name him in their household prayers. Is Uncle Williamson therefore his son? She asks. Joanne tries to explain it. Save your breath, Anne says. She taps her head. Her bright little fingers bounce from the seed pearls of her cap. Slow, she says. Later he says to her, Grace isn't slow, just young. I never remember I was as foolish as that. They're all slow except us. Is that right? Anne's face says more or less that is right. Why do people marry? So there can be children. Horses don't marry, but there are foals. Most people, he says, feel it increases their happiness. Oh, yes, that, Anne says. May I choose my husband? Of course, he says, meaning up to a point. Then I choose Rafe. For a minute, for 2 minutes together, he feels his life might mend. Then he thinks, how can I ask Rafe to wait? He needs to set up his own household. Even 5 years from now, Anne would be a very young bride. I know, she says, and time goes by so slowly. It's true. One always seems to be waiting for something. You seem to have thought it through, he says. You don't have to spell out to her. Keep this to yourself, because she knows to do that. You don't have to lead this female child through a conversation with the little shifts and demurs that most women demand. She's not like a flower, a nightingale. She's like a merchant adventurer, he thinks. A look in the eye to skewer your intentions, and a deal done with a slap of the palm. She pulls off her cap. She twists the seed pearls in her fingers and tugs at a strand of her dark hair, stretching it and pulling out its wave. She scoops up the rest of her hair, twists it, and wraps it around her neck. I could do that twice, she says, if my neck were smaller. She sounds fretful. Grace thinks I cannot marry Rafe because we are related. She thinks everybody who lives in a house must be cousins. You are not Rafe's cousin. Are you sure? I am sure. And put your cap back on. What will your aunt say? She makes a face. It is a face imitative of her Aunt Joanne. Oh, Thomas, she murmurs, you are always so sure. He raises a hand to cover his smile. For a moment, Joanne seems less worrying. Put your cap on, he says mildly. She squashes it back on her head. She is so little, he thinks, but still she'd be better suited by a helmet. How did Rafe come here? She says. He came here from Essex, because that's where his father happened to be at the time. His father, Henry, was a steward to Sir Edward Belknap, who was a cousin of the Grey family, and so related to the Marquis of Dorset, and the Marquis was Wolsey's patron when the Cardinal was a scholar at Oxford. So, yes, cousins come into it. And the fact that, when he'd only been back in England for a year or two, he was already somehow in the Cardinal's affinity, though he'd never set eyes on the great man himself. Already he, Cromwell, was a man useful to employ. He worked for the Dorset family on various of their tangled lawsuits. The old marchioness had him tracking down bed hangings and carpets for her. Send that, be here. To her, all the world was a menial. If she wanted a lobster or a sturgeon, she ordered it up. And if she wanted good taste, she ordered it in the same way. The marchioness would run her hand over Florentine silks, making little squeaks of pleasure. "You bought it, Master Cromwell," she would say, "and very beautiful it is. Your next task is to work out how we pay for it." Somewhere in this maze of obligations and duties, he met Henry Sadler, and agreed to take his son to his household. "Teach him all you know," Henry proposed, a little fearfully. He arranged to collect Rafe on his way back from business in his part of the country, but he picked a bad day for it. Mud and drenching rain, clouds chasing in from the coast. It was not much after two when he splashed up to the door, but the light was already failing. Henry Sadler said, "Can't you stay? You won't make it back to London before they close the gates." "I ought to try to get home tonight," he said. "I have to be in court. And then there'll be my Lady Dorset's debt collector to see off, and you know how that is." Mistress Sadler glanced fearfully outside and down at her child, for whom she must now part, trusting him, at the age of 7, to the weather and the roads. This is not harsh. This is usual. But Rafe was so small that he almost thought it harsh. His baby curls had been cropped, and his ginger hair stood up at the crown. His mother and father knelt down and patted him. Then they swaddled and pulled and knotted him into multiple layers of overwrapped padding, so that his slight frame swelled into the likeness of a small barrel. He looked down at the child and out at the rain and thought, "Sometimes I should be warm and dry like other men. How do they contrive it while I never can?" Mistress Sadler knelt and took her son's face in her hands. "Remember everything we have told you," she whispered. "Say your prayers. Master Cromwell, please see he says his prayers." When she looked up, he saw that her eyes were blurred with tears, and he saw that the child could not bear it, and was shaking inside his vast wrappings and about to howl. He threw his cloak around himself. A scatter of raindrops flew from it, baptized the scene. "Well, Rafe, what do you think? If you're man enough?" He held out his gauntleted hand. The child's hand slotted into it. "Shall we see how far we get?" "We'll do this fast, so you don't look back," he thought. The wind and rain drove the parents back from the open door. He threw Rafe into the saddle. The rain came at them horizontally. On the outskirts of London, the wind dropped. He lived at Fenchurch Street then. At the door, a servant held out his arms in an offer to take Rafe. But he said, "We drowned men will stick together." The child had become a dead weight in his arms, shrinking flesh inside 7 sodden layers of interwrapped wool. He stood Rafe before the fire. Vapours rose from him. Roused by the warmth, he put up small frozen fingers and tentatively began to unpick, to unravel himself. "What place is this?" he said, in a distinct, polite tone. "London," he said. "Fenchurch Street. Home." He took a linen towel and gently blotted from his face the journey just past. He rubbed his head. Rafe's hair stood up in spikes. Liz came in. "Heaven direct me, boy or hedgehog?" Rafe turned his face to her. He smiled. He slept on his feet. When the sweat comes back this summer, 1528, people say, as they did last year, that you won't get it if you don't think about it. But how can you not? He sends the girls out of London, first to the Stepney House and then beyond. This time the court is infected. Henry tries to outride the plague, moving from one hunting lodge to the next. Anne is sent to Hever. The fever breaks out there amongst the Boleyn family, and the lady's father goes down first. He lives. Her sister Mary's husband dies. Anne falls ill, but within 24 hours she's reported back on her feet. Still, it can wreck a woman's looks. "You don't know what outcome to pray for," he says to the cardinal. The cardinal says, "I am praying for Queen Catherine, and also for the dear Lady Anne. I am praying for King Francois's armies in Italy, that they may meet with success, and yet not so much success that they forget how they need their friend and ally King Henry. I am praying for the King's Majesty and all his counsellors, and for the beasts in the field, and for the Holy Father and the Curia. May their decisions be guided from above. I am praying for Martin Luther, and for all those infected with this heresy, and for all who combat him, most especially the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, our dear friend Thomas More. Against all common sense and observation, I am praying for a good harvest, and for the rain to stop. I am praying for everybody. I am praying for everything. That is what it is to be a cardinal. Only when I say to the Lord, "Now about Thomas Cromwell," does God say to me, "Wolsey, what have I told you? Don't you know when to give up?" When the infection reaches Hampton Court, the cardinal seals himself off from the world. Only four servants are allowed to approach him. When he re-emerges, he does look as if he's been praying. At the end of the summer, when the girls come back to London, they have grown, and Grace's hair has been bleached by the sun. She is shy of him, and he wonders if now she can only associate him with that night when he carried her to bed, after she had been told her mother was dead. Anne says, "Next summer, whatever happens, I prefer to stay with you." The sickness has left the city, but the cardinal's prayers have met with variable success. The harvest is poor. The French are losing badly in Italy, and their commander has died of plague. Autumn comes. Gregory goes back to his tutor. His reluctance is clear enough, though little about Gregory is clear to him. "What is it?" he asks him. "What's wrong?" The boy won't say. With other people he is sunny and lively, but with his father, guarded and polite, as if to keep a formal distance between them. He says to Joanne, "Is Gregory frightened of me?" Quick as a needle into canvas, she darts at him. "He's not a monk. Has he cause?" Then she softens. "Thomas, why should he be? You're a kind father. In fact, I think too much so." "If he doesn't want to go back to his tutor, I could send him to Antwerp, to my friend Stephen Vaughan. Gregory will never make a man of business." "No. You can't see him beating out a deal on interest rates with one of the Fugger's agents or some sniggering de Medici clerk. So what will I do with him?" "I'll tell you what to do. When he is ready, marry him well. Gregory is a gentleman. Anyone can see that." Anne is eager to make a start with Greek. He's thinking who best to teach her, asking around. He wants someone congenial, whom he can talk to over supper, a young scholar who will live in the house. He regrets the choice of tutor he's made for his son and nephews, but he won't take them away at this point. The man is quarrelsome, and to be sure, there was a sad episode when one of the boys set fire to his room because he'd been reading in bed with a candle. "It wouldn't be Gregory, would it?" he had said, always hopeful. The master seemed to think he was treating it as a joke. "And he's always sending him bills that he believes he's paid. I need a household accountant," he thinks. He sits at his desk, piled high with drawings and plans from Ipswich and Cardinal College, with craftsmen's estimates and bills for Wolsey's planting schemes. He examines a scar in the palm of his hand. It is an old burn mark, and it looks like a twist of rope. He thinks about Putney. He thinks about Walter. He thinks about the jittery sidestep of a skittish horse, the smell of the brewery. He thinks about the kitchen at Lambeth, and about the tow-headed boy who used to bring the eels. He remembers taking the eel boy by the hair and dipping his head in a tub of water and holding it under. He thinks, "Did I really do that? I wonder why." The cardinal's probably right. "I am beyond redemption." The scar sometimes itches. It is as hard as a spur of bone. He thinks, "I need an accountant. I need a Greek tutor. I need Joanne. But who says I can have what I need?" He opens a letter. It is from a priest called Thomas Bird. He is in want of money, and it seems the Cardinal owes him some. He makes a note to have it checked out and paid, then picks up the letter again. It mentions two men, two scholars, Clark and Sumner. He knows the names. They're two of the six college men, the Oxford men who had the Lutheran books. Lock them up and reason with them, the Cardinal had said. He holds the letter and glances away from it. He knows something bad is coming. Its shadow moves on the wall. He reads. Clark and Sumner are dead. The Cardinal should be told, the writer says. Having no other secure place, the Dean saw fit to shut them in the college cellars, the deep cold cellars intended for storing fish. Even in that silent place, secret, icy, the summer plague sought them out. They died in the dark and without a priest. All summer we have prayed, and not prayed hard enough. Had the Cardinal simply forgotten his heretics? I must go and tell him, he thinks. It is the first week in September. His suppressed grief becomes anger. But what can he do with anger? It also must be suppressed. But when at last the year turns and the Cardinal says, Thomas, what shall I give you for a New Year gift? He says, give me a little Bilney. And without waiting for the Cardinal to answer, he says, my lord, he's been in the Tower for a year. The Tower would frighten anyone, but Bilney is a timid man, and not strong, and I am afraid he's straitly kept. And, my lord, you remember Sumner and Clark and how they died? My lord, use your power, write letters, petition the king if you must. Let him go. The Cardinal leans back. He puts his fingertips together. Thomas, he says, my dear Thomas Cromwell. Very well. But Father Bilney must go back to Cambridge. He must give up his project of going to Rome and addressing the Pope to bring him to a right way of thinking. There are very deep vaults under the Vatican, and my arm will not be able to reach him there. It is at the tip of his tongue to say, you could not reach into the cellars of your own college. But he stops himself. Heresy, his brush with it, is a little indulgence that the Cardinal allows him. He's always glad to have the latest bad books filleted, and any gossip from the steelyard where the German merchants live. He's happy to turn over a text or two, to enjoy an after-supper debate. But for the Cardinal, any contentious point must be wrapped around and around again with a fine filament of words, fine as split hairs. Any dangerous opinion must be so plumped out with laughing apologies that it is as fat and harmless as the cushions you lean on. It is true that when he was told of the deaths underground, my lord was moved to tears. How could I not have known, he said, those fine young men? He cries easily in recent months, though that does not mean his tears are less genuine. And indeed now he wipes away a tear, because he knows the story. Little Bilney at Gray's Inn, the man who spoke Polish, the futile messengers, the dazed children, Elizabeth Cromwell's face set in the fixed severity of death. He leans across his desk and says, Thomas, please don't despair. You still have your children, and in time you may wish to marry again. I am a child, he thinks, who cannot be consoled. The Cardinal places his hand over his. The strange stones flicker in the light, showing their depths. A garnet like a blood bubble. A turquoise with a silver sheen, a diamond with a yellow-grey blink like the eye of a cat. He will never tell the Cardinal about Mary Boleyn, though the impulse will arise. Wolsey might laugh, he might be scandalized. He has to smuggle him the content, without the context. Autumn 1528. He is at court on the Cardinal's business. Mary is running towards him, her skirts lifted, showing a fine pair of green silk stockings. Is her sister Anne chasing her? He waits to see. She stops abruptly. Ah, it's you. He wouldn't have thought Mary knew him. She puts one hand against the panelling, catching her breath, and the other against his shoulder. as if he were just part of the wall. Mary is still dazzlingly pretty, fair, soft-featured. "My uncle this morning," she says, "my uncle Norfolk, he was roaring against you. I said to my sister, 'Who is this terrible man?' And she said, 'He's the one who looks like a wall.'" Mary takes her hand away. She laughs, blushes, and with a little heave of her bosom, tries to get her breath back. "What was my Lord of Norfolk's complaint?" "Oh," she flaps her hand to fan herself, "he said, cardinals, legates, it was never merry in England when we had cardinals among us. He says the Cardinal of York is despoiling the noble houses. He says he will have all to rule himself, and the lords to be like schoolboys creeping in for a whipping. Not that you should take any notice of what I say." She looks fragile, breathless still, but his eyes tell her to talk. She gives a little laugh and says, "My brother George roared too. He said that the Cardinal of York was born in a hospital for paupers, and he employs a man was born in the gutter. My lord father said, 'Come now, my dear boy, you lose nothing if you are exact. Not quite a gutter, but a brewer's yard, I believe, for he's certainly no gentleman.'" Mary takes a step back. "You look a gentleman. I like your grey velvet. Where did you find that?" "Italy." "He has been promoted from being the wall." Mary's hand creeps back. Absorbed, she strokes him. "Could you get me some? They're a bit sober for a woman, perhaps." "Not for a widow," he thinks. The thought must show on his face, because Mary says, "That's it, you see. William Carey's dead." He bows his head and is very correct. Mary alarms him. "The court misses him sadly, as you must yourself." A sigh. "He was kind, given the circumstances." "It must have been difficult for you." "When the king turned his mind to Anne, he thought that, knowing how things are done in France, she might accept a certain position in the court. And in his heart, as he put it, he said he would give up all other mistresses. The letters he has written in his own hand."
"Really?"
"The cardinal always says that you can never get the king to write a letter himself, even to another king, even to the Pope, even when it might make a difference."
"Yes. Since last summer, he writes, and then sometimes where he would sign Henricus Rex."
She takes his hand, turns up his palm, and with her forefinger traces a shape.
"Where he should sign his name, instead he draws a heart, and he puts their initials in it."
"Oh, you mustn't laugh." She can't keep the smile off her face.
"He says he is suffering."
He wants to say, "Mary, these letters, can you steal them for me?"
"My sister says this is not France, and I am not a fool like you, Mary. She knows I was Henry's mistress, and she sees how I am left, and she takes a lesson from it."
He's almost holding his breath, but she's reckless now. She will have her say.
"I tell you, they will ride over hell to marry. They have vowed it. Anne says she will have him, and she cares not if Catherine and every Spaniard is in the sea and drowned. What Henry wants, he will have, and what Anne wants, she will have. And I can say that because I know them both. Who better?"
Her eyes are soft and welling with tears.
"So that is why," she says, "why I miss William Carey, because now she is everything, and I am to be swept out after supper like the old rushers. Now I'm no one's wife. They can say anything they like to me. My father says I'm a mouth to feed, and my uncle Norfolk says I'm a whore."
"As if he didn't make you one. Are you short of money?"
"Oh, yes, 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 yes. And no one has even thought about that. No one has even asked me before. I have children, you know that. I need—"
She presses her fingers against her mouth to stop it trembling.
"If you saw my son, well, why do you think I called him Henry? The king would have owned him as his son, just as he has owned Richmond, but my sister forbade it. He does what she says. She means to give him a prince herself, so she doesn't want mine in his nursery."
Reports have been sent to the cardinal. Mary Boleyn's child is a healthy boy with red-gold hair and lively appetites. She has a daughter, older, But in the context, that's not so interesting, a daughter. He says, "What age is your son now, Lady Carey?"
3 in March. And my girl Catherine is 5.